Well, the first presentation this afternoon is from Dr. Mari Jacobsen. I first met Mari at the first international negotiations on the environmental protocol in Viña del Mar in Chile in late 1990. At that time, Mari was writing her doctoral thesis on the Antarctic Treaty. Mari is principal legal advisor on international law at the Swedish Ministry of Foreign Affairs and a member of the UN International Law Commission. She has a very long-standing interest in the polar regions, both on a professional and an academic basis. And recently, Mari Jacobsen's book on international law, The Sea and the Individual, has just been published. Mari.
Thank you, Mike. Not Mike. Thank you, Mike. Ladies and gentlemen, friends and friends of the Antarctic, I will give a presentation that you might think that you've heard already this morning, because it turned out that it's a little bit overlapping to that of my friend and colleague, Professor Gillian Triggs. But I will try to shed the light on a few other aspects that she didn't really bring forward, as well as make a few comments on the history of the Antarctic Treaty negotiations that has not up to now been addressed. And so this is what I would like to do. And since the title of my presentation is Building the International Legal Framework for Antarctica, I will have to start with the history. And given the fact that the history session this morning, I left some issues aside or not really illuminated, I think that I'll take the opportunity to use some of my time to raise issues relating to that. And I'll take you back a little bit further than some of the other speakers, although not as far back as Fred Root took us. But now imagine that you're in a situation that you have a pristine continent, cold as ice, extremely windy and dry, and almost as giant as Latin America, and clearly larger than Europe, but with very little human activities. And this continent was about to become the scene of an international discord, and you had to solve the problem. What would you do? It was clear that you would need a legal and a political solution, and that there is no room for one winner. There is no room for one loser. There is only room for winners, in plural. Now, this was the situation that a number of particularly concerned states faced in the 1940s when they needed to address how Antarctica should be managed. So what were the challenges? There were primarily four. First, they had to find a solution that would be accepted domestically. Second, they had to settle the issue among the most concerned states. Third, they had to meet the challenges of states not involved in the discussions. And fourth, they had to meet the challenges of non-state actors. And this is what my presentation will address, with some emphasis on the historical background. The necessity for a new power structure was already apparent during the Second World War, and so was the need for new principles of law and politics to be inaugurated and upheld. The post-World War political discussion on Antarctica were no doubt influenced by the adoption of the UN Charter in San Francisco in 1945. Regional solutions became a sanctioned and encouraged means of conflict moderation, explicitly addressed in Article 52 of the UN Charter. At least two Latin American claimants, the two, have endeavored to regard Antarctica as a regional matter, whereas the U.S. regarded Antarctica as a sphere of interest among a group of friendly power states, friendly to the United States. Before I recall what took place at the intergovernmental level, let me bring to mind that the interest in Antarctic issues has never been limited to governmental interest, and this has been stressed earlier today, and I'd like to stress it again. On the contrary, popular interest in the polar regions has always been considerable. The post-Second World War situation stimulated individuals as well as international organizations to bring forward ideas pertaining to the administration of polar areas. The role of the newborn United Nations seemed self-evident to many. And Gillian Tricht referred to the initiative by the International Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And it was really a little bit more of a mature proposal that might have been indicated in her presentations, since their idea of placing Antarctica or the polar regions under the Trusteeship Council of the UN was actually brought up by the Trusteeship Council, but it never did fly there. Now, there were other proposals, such as the one made in 1947 by the Julian Huxley, who somebody else also has referred to, of UNESCO, who wished to see UNESCO set up an international Arctic research institute. And individuals like the member of the British Parliament, Lord Edward Shackleton, son of the explorer, Ernest Shackleton, was in favor of involvement of the UN in Antarctic issues. And there are many other examples as well. So although the Second World War had carried with it a decrease in scientific activities in Antarctica, the political predicament with respect to Antarctica, in particular the question of sovereignty, became more and more tense as British, US, Argentine and Chilean activities during the end of the Second World War clearly showed. And Cordelia Lüdecke really made a good presentation of the different military and other expeditions that took place during that time. The obvious increased tension in Antarctica, together with the growing embarrassment to the United States to have three of its allies, namely Chile, Argentina, and United Kingdom, as antagonists with respect to sovereignty disputes, no doubt contributed to a conviction in the State Department that there was a compelling need for a more vigorous solution. And in the State Department, there was a clear fear that the Soviet Union would exploit the situation. So the United States had to come up with a proposal that struck the balance between the United States' interest in Antarctica and the claimant state's interest, but at the same time did circumvent the perceived risk of Soviet involvement. And therefore, the U.S. became a key player in initiating the consultations on Antarctica in the late 40s. In fact, the suggestions and initiatives relating to the future management of Antarctica were numerous, and the United States was not the only one that took the initiatives. In sum, one can say that despite the belief to the contrary, the first viable proposal after the Second World War came from Chile, and the action that led to the Antarctic Treaty came from the United Kingdom. It was in the late 1939 that the United States had put forward a proposal on inter alia for the purpose of entering into an arrangement should investigations and surveys show that the natural resources might develop and be utilized in Antarctica. According to the U.S. proposal, all these governments that they had in mind should enjoy equal opportunity to participate in the development of and utilization of those resources. This initiative in 1939 was clearly related to the claims and the issue of enjoying equal rights and in relation to possible development and utilization. But also Argentina had put forward the idea of a conference in Antarctica in 1940 and proposing that an international conference among the states claiming rights and interest in Antarctica be held. The U.S. initiative 1939-41 on a common inter-American policy on Antarctica was unsuccessful. And when Chile in 1947 chose to resuscitate the U.S. idea, the United States was already in the process of reconsidering its Antarctic policy. And the U.S. response to Chile was therefore that the time was not opportune for such a conference, while also assuring that the U.S. attitude remains essentially the same as it was at the time, that is, 1939. At the same time, the internal discussions in the U.S. were intense. Although the United States first favored a trusteeship solution and other alternatives were contemplated primarily an international administration in the form of a condominium. And now I'll turn to the draft agreement 1948 that has been addressed by many. But before I really get to that particular draft agreement from August, I like to say that already in the early months of 1948, this draft agreement paper was prepared by the State Department. And it should be noted that this paper recommends the establishment of international status for Antarctica, but also that the United States should make an official claim to areas Antarctica so as to place the United States, and I quote, on an equal footing with the other seven powers. The claim was not to be announced until after the international settlement had been obtained. And the draft contained a proposal for the establishment of a trusteeship under the UN and a joint sovereignty over the continent among eight countries: Argentina, Australia, Chile, France, Norway, New Zealand, United Kingdom, and the United States. In reality, the United States draft was a combination of a trusteeship proposal and a condominium. And not surprisingly, the idea of pooling claims turned out not to appeal to the claimant states, irrespective of U.S. ambitions to blur this by the attempt to launch proposal as a trusteeship proposal. It should be said that it was not the U.S. objective at this time to declare Antarctica a demilitarized area, notwithstanding the major objective to lower tensions in the area. During the development of the proposal, the United States consulted few other governments. The consultations with the United Kingdom and later with Chile were, however, crucial to the development. And the United Kingdom, which was the first country to be informed, indicated that an eighth power condominium was preferable to a trusteeship under the UN, since a trusteeship solution would allow for the Soviet Union to interfere. The British reaction caused the State Department to elaborate a revised draft agreement to provide for a condominium, and it is that draft agreement that we see in August 1948. But even before that, a representative of the State Department arrived in Santiago and thereafter in Buenos Aires in order to discuss the Antarctic issue. And it was during the discussions in Santiago that the Chilean representative, Professor Escudero, expressed doubts as to whether a trusteeship would be applicable under the Charter, and instead voiced the idea of a joint declaration by a limited group of states which would freeze the current legal rights and interests in Antarctica for a period of 5 or 10 years. During this period, actions in Antarctica by the states parties to the declaration would have no legal effects on the rights. This was the so-called modus vivendi proposal, an embryonic form of the Escudero proposal, later presented and designed to be a means of conflict moderation, as well as to prevent any interpretation that Chile or other claimants would relinquish the claims to sovereignty. At this stage, the U.S. neglected the Chilean idea of a modus vivendi agreement and decided instead to present a new version of its previous proposals to a wider circle of interested states, which included, as I said earlier, Chile, Argentina, Australia, France, New Zealand, Norway, and the United Kingdom. This version was built on the comments made by the UK. The trusteeship idea was abandoned and turned into a pure proposal for a condominium. And the obligation to cooperate with the special agencies of the United Nations now constituted the only connection with the United Nations. Furthermore, I should now rather say that it was not surprising that this proposal was not embraced wholeheartedly by the recipients, most of whom neither had any idea about what was going on, nor had seen the proposal in advance. Hence, the responses varied from a scale of disapproval to skeptical consent. Argentina declared a clearly negative view to any international regime. Chile disapproved of the condominium solution, but underlined the favorable attitude to the modus vivendi solution. Norway considered the establishment of an international administration as, I quote, unnecessary. Having initially taken an unfavorable view, Australia and New Zealand declared their willingness to go along, but New Zealand underlined that the closer relation with the UN was preferable. France was reluctant and asked for clarification, and the United Kingdom cautiously advised about its acceptance in principle and as a basis for discussion. None of the claimants were prepared to waive their claims and turned it into a pooled sovereignty. And it became worse, because when the United States made its initiative public on 28 August 1948, the reactions from states which had not been consulted did not fail to appear. For example, both South Africa and Belgium declared that they considered themselves entitled to participate in an Antarctic settlement. The negative responses to the specific proposal by the United States, together with the positive views expressed on international solutions to the parts of the Antarctic question, such as scientific cooperation, led the United States to reconsider its proposal, and it concluded that it was the Chilean proposal that offered the best prospect if it were modified on certain points, and it was considered to be too temporary and declaratory in nature, and that had to be changed. So there were a number of other proposals in the 1950s also that came from the United States, and the United States at the time had very close cooperation with Chile. But they had not calculated with the action from the Soviet Union. In fact, the State Department, and it's very clear from the dossier, had calculated that its first move in 1948 would prevent Soviet intervention in the process, and that the exclusion, of course, of the Soviet Union was a paramount objective in the United States. In June 1950, the Soviet Union, however, handed over a memorandum to the United States and the other states, clearly stating that the Soviet Union cannot recognize as legal any decision regarding the regime of Antarctica without its participation. So, and then we had some sort of a lapse in the international negotiation. It was during the Cold War, but the discussions and the exchange of view never really stopped. And this is worth recalling, because some people have written that there were no discussions in the 1950s, but there were. In 1955, the United Kingdom filed the Antarctica cases with the International Court of Justice. The New Zealand Prime Minister Walter Nash proposed that Antarctica should be a UN trusteeship, and even proposed the abandonment of claims. India proposed that Antarctica should be placed on the UN agenda, apparently because it was afraid that Antarctica be utilized for nuclear testing. And in 1957, in parallel to the IGY, the US realized that it was a need to revise its politics on Antarctica. But before they had formulated a policy, the United Kingdom proposed quadripartite talks between the US, Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom. And they took place in London. And the major difference between the US and the UK view at the time was the view on the Soviet participation, because the UK took a far much more realistic view and realized that the Soviet Union could not be left aside. So what were the elements from all these two decades of discussions that bore fruit? I'll list them now. First, it was the removal of Antarctica from the arena of international disputes. Second, it was the safeguarding of individual interest, limited participation by states with special interest. It was the obligation to cooperate with the United Nations and other organizations, the freedom of scientific research, the public interest and the benefit of science progress to people, the peaceful use that later became demilitarization, the exploitation and conservation of resources, the territorial scope south of 60 degrees latitude, and the consensus rule, and the duration, the unlimited duration of the treaty. In conclusion, it could therefore be maintained that the most elements of the Antarctic Treaty can be traced back to previous proposal, not least to the so-called Escudero proposal in 1948. But the political ambitions alone did not lead to any result until 1957, when help came from a seemingly non-political arrangement, namely the International Geophysical Year. And Dr. Lüdecker has addressed the issue and the role of the IGY, so I will not dwell on it. What I would like to do, however, is to say that the primary reason why the results of the political understanding of the IGY is interesting to a lawyer is because the Antarctic Treaty has a clear reference to the IGY in Article 2. So you have really to know what was the features of the IGY. And I'll list them here. First of all, it was the gentleman's agreement, that is, that you put aside the political and legal struggle and aim for a practical result. Second, it was the feature of participation and openness. Third, it was the need to be present in Antarctica or show an interest in the activities. Fourthly, it was the access to scientific data and cooperation. And fifthly, it was the requirement for unanimity in decision making. I will now briefly conclude by just mentioning that all these ideas was later formulated in the Antarctic Treaty, and I know that Tucker Scully will address these issues. You can also see, and I just like to conclude this, and I'm soon there, don't worry, by saying that the Antarctic Treaty was the first treaty in the building of the Antarctic Treaty system. The other treaties that came after the agreed measures of the protection of Antarctic flora and fauna, the CCAS, the SEAL Convention, the CAMELAR, and CRAMRA, all helped to build the Antarctic Treaty system that we have and that we see today. And here I will be in agreement with the young scholar from Korea. What are the future challenges of the Antarctic Treaty for the Antarctic Treaty parties? And I think that the Antarctic Treaty parties face challenges, not when it comes to the IUU fishing. That is not a particularly threat to the system as a whole, and not because of the issue of tourism. That is not a threat to the Antarctic Treaty system. But the continental shelf claims and the biodiversity and bioprospecting, this is something that the Antarctic Treaty parties will have to address in the future in one way or another. Thank you.
Thank you, Mari. And don't go. As with the other speakers, it gives me great pleasure to present you with, on behalf of the International Board, with a medal. Thank you very much indeed.